Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome back. If you're a new listener, I'd like to let you know that this is a two-hour show in which we try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. In the first hour of the show, we ask questions that matter, avoiding politics, instead focusing on the issues that underlie politics and current events, issues that affect us all, young or old, locally and globally. In this, the second hour, we balance the creative with the intellectual by featuring in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because discussion and creativity, I feel, are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. And if you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website. It's a question of balance. com. You can hear podcasts of all previous shows there, and you can connect with me on social media should you wish. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm very pleased to be interviewing Merce. Hailing from Los Angeles and creating great music since the early 90s, Merce is an indie rap icon who has recorded multiple albums and has performed all over the world. Originally a member of Three Melancholy Gypsies, Merce joined up with The Grouch and Mystic Journeyman to form Living Legends, which LA Weekly described as one of the biggest success stories of the indie rap movement, having sold close to 300,000 units all by them damn selves. A prolific artist, Merce has created both quality solo albums and collaboration projects with many artists, including Mayday, Ninth Wonder and Fashawn. His consistently intelligent, thoughtful and charismatic work has engendered a dedicated following of fans. iTunes comments that Merce's low-key intelligence and self-deprecatory indignation make him a curiously modest figure on a hip-hop scene filled with inflated egos. His many album releases include a 10-track concept album called Yumiko, Curse of the Merch Girl, a collaboration with artists and writers which is accompanied by a 100-page graphic novel. Merce recently moved record companies to Strange Music, and his new album, Have a Nice Life, is coming out on the 18th of May. Welcome to the show, Merce.
Hello. Nice to see you, Ruth, or hear you.
You too. And I know you're on tour, so I really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us. I wanted to ask you, from a young age, you've immersed yourself in your art. I'm wondering if you can remember your earliest encounter with music or art of any kind that inspired you and gave you a sense of your own potential creativity, maybe made you want to be an artist.
I would say it was in kindergarten, we had a show and tell. So I was probably about 4 or 5.
Uh-huh.
And everyone brought in toys or snacks, and I brought in a record, which was Double Dutch Bus, and I can't remember the artist for the life of me right now.
Uh-huh.
But it was definitely a moment where I realized I took music a little bit more seriously than most children.
Right. That's an early start in kindergarten. That's impressive. When did you start writing raps?
I was probably about 12 or 11 in junior high school after hearing the Simpsons Sing the Blues album. Bart had a rap, and I felt like I had been freestyling or like improv rapping with my friends before that. And after that, I decided that I would start to try to write stories and write songs.
Right. So would you say rapping is very largely about storytelling for you?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like that's what I do best when I write songs. And those are some of the songs I enjoy most. And I also enjoy, reading. And when I love reading autobiographies, I have to stop. Because that's all I'd read if I didn't stop myself.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Are you reading one at the moment?
No, I'm stopping. I was reading Willie Nelson's, but I stopped to read The Road Less Traveled, which is an excellent book.
Yes.
And more self-help.
Yeah, that's a great book. I've read that. It's Good book. Very thought-provoking.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you started out writing, I was wondering how you went about kind of honing what you were doing, developing your craft.
Unfortunately, I would say in the beginning, it was a lot about compare and contrast and just writing it and seeing how it measured up against what I listened to and what I love. And that always made me want to get better because I've always been a big fan of just hip-hop in general.
Yes.
But unfortunately, it made it, for a while, I felt unattainable or inferior because I put these people on such a pedestal. But it was good to get started that way because I think it made me work harder.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword that when you admire people, it can really drive you on. But then, like you say, if you compare yourself too much, then it can make you feel like, oh, God, I'll never get there.
Exactly.
Yeah. The breadth of what you consider in your art is really refreshing. You know, you do talk about love and sex, but from many different perspectives, not just the usual. And you talk about social justice, peace, how you hate the fact that religion separates us. You're obviously a very thoughtful person who's curious about life, and you're not just living it, you're observing it. So I'm interested in how you start a song. How do you choose what to focus on, and how does that then come to be a finished song?
Usually it's the music. Early on, I would just write what came to mind, and now I kind of I have ideas that I want to do stories or songs about, and when I hear the right type of music, or I'll tell the producer this is what I'm feeling, and then they'll create some music that reflects that subject matter to them, and we go from there. But a lot of times it's just listening to a lot of beats that different beat makers send me and picking the one that says, oh, that feels like what I've been trying to say.
Right. Now, what I've read about you, you write first. You're very word orientated. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. When I listen to the songs, I never hear the music. I'm not really musically inclined. I'm very much about the word and what's being conveyed in the song. So that usually comes first for me. I usually have an idea, or an idea that's been waiting for a beat for a while, and a couple of I don't know if we call them stanzas, we say bars. Prepare it, and then once I hear the music, I can kind of write it so that there's a better melody. Early on, I wasn't really looking for melodies, and I think that, you know, that's the difference between a song I have called Animal Style, which is a story about gay teen suicide, and Macklemore's Same Love Song. Like, he's more concerned with melodies. They both have a very positive pro same-sex marriage message, but his was a hit record because he was concentrating on melodies, and mine is, I think, a great story and a great song and very impactful, but I'm not as easy to digest by the masses. And if you want to make an impact, you should be more concerned with melody than you are content sometimes.
Right, yeah. Although I think, you know, that's something that's happened over, I don't know exactly what period, the last 15 years, where it seems there's this dumbing down of music generally in terms of complexity with melody and words, just so that it can be instantly consumed. I mean, I know when I was growing up, you know, you'd hear DJs say, you know, give this a listen, you might need to listen to it 3 or 4 times, but then you just will never want to not hear it again. Have you seen that too, that, you know, there's this sort of drive to just like something within 60 seconds?
Yeah, I feel like definitely as music has become more of a business and more commodified, I feel that people's goal is to make easily digestible music. But to me, the Beatles are the greatest group in the history of music, and I debate it with a lot of people, but I think their music is perfect because, you know, and even John Lennon post-Beatles, like Imagine is a great song, but it's the melody that he was able to combine such, I don't think he dumbed it down at all. He just found this perfect marriage where he was giving this amazing message and the music was amazing and catchy, so you love it the first time you hear it, and then it's infectious, and next thing you know, you're reciting it. To me, it was like a beautiful mantra and a positive mantra.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you are bringing out, mentioning the Beatles, is that they did have music that was instantly likable, but not because it was dumbed down, as you're saying. I mean, the melodies they came up with were just so engaging and beautiful, and that's why they were the Beatles. I mean, you know, it's and the content. I mean, what they talked about was so interesting. If you look through their catalogue, you know, there's just so many different things they're talking about. It's not just love. I mean, the earlier stuff, but that's appealing, I think, the breadth of what they talk about too.
Definitely.
Yeah. Speaking of which, some of the things you say are quite profound. I found myself turning over certain phrases from songs, and each one of them could be, you know, the start of a stimulating discussion. For example, what's wrong with peace? Or love is all about progress, not perfection. Or does God feel emotion? Is there an overarching message you're trying to communicate through your work, or is each song different for you, what you're trying to say?
I feel I definitely, overall, my message is peace and love, you know, because what I realized over the years as I traveled the world, and, you know, for me, traveling the world is different from most artists because I started at an indie level. So my first tour was, I had just turned 18, and we flew into Amsterdam, and I was living in Groningen, Holland, sleeping on people's floors and, you know, stealing food from the grocery store to eat. But living in the community, living amongst other people, not just coming in for a date and disappearing the next day.
Right.
You know, so I was traveling and taking the train, and, you know, what I slowly began to realize over the years is that, you know, we all have different ways of approaching our problems, but at the end of the day, we all want to be happy. We all want love. So it's trying to, you know, whether, you know, with the does God feel emotion, whether you're an atheist or you're a devout Christian or Muslim, you want world peace. You want to be happy. No one, whether you're Republican or a Democrat or a Nazi or a Jew, like you want your children to be happy. No one's going to say, you know, 999,999 times out of a million, the person's, no one's going to say, I want my children to be miserable and I want to be unhappy for the rest of my life. We just all have different ways of going about attaining happiness and bliss.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of the underlying theme of my show, is that, you know, do we have more in common than divides us? And, you know, I personally think that we do. And yet in the world, so often it is presented in a way that we're made to feel that we don't. And I think what you're saying is true. There is this common thing. We all want to be happy. And, you know, you mentioned the Beatles and, you know, their song, All We Need Is Love. You know, it can sound like a truism, but, I mean, basically that is it, isn't it? It doesn't need to get more complicated than that.
Not at all.
Yeah. If you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest, rap icon Merce. We're going to go to a commercial break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Do you like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, Merce. Your new album release from Strange Music is called Have a Nice Life, and it comes out on May 18th. You've got two singles currently available to purchase, No More Control and Okie Dog. I've pre-ordered my album, so I've got those
Thank
two
you.
Singles. And I shall have all the other ones as soon as it comes out. So listeners can go and do that too. You can pre-order and make sure that you hear everything immediately. I'd like to play Okie Dog first, and it's got a great video, by the way, if listeners want to check it out. So this is Okie Dog from Have a Nice Life.
Once upon a time there was a one-man gang who never ran from anyone or sold. OGs in the city all knew his name. So here's a little story about the gang that he claimed. The hottest I know, he from Okie Dog crib. When he get up out the pen, better hope he don't trip. Teriyaki up pastrami, he was always in some beef. A legend to this day, they talk about him in the streets. It's not a real hood, it's something that he made up to piss gangbangers off, cause he never gave a f***. He wore white pro wings with pink and green strings, and dare anybody on the shore to say a thing. Seen him knock a lot of dudes out with one swing. By his side, he always kept the baddest f*** you ever seen. Made his first million by the age of 17, running credit card scams, never touched a triple beam. He was the king, everybody tried to trip on him. They would get confused when he Okie Dog crip on him. Most of the time they would just start laughing, but they all got knocked out quick just for asking. Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from? Okie Dog crip and y'all don't want none.
Yeah.
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Okie Dog crip and y'all don't want none. I know he from Okie Dog crib. Once knocked it out and he broke his own fist like this. In LA, you get hit up every day. The homie had to come up with something different to say. He like, no matter what I say, they gon' always wanna fight. I'd rather get into it over something that I like. And the one thing I love in this world above all is the teriyaki burger that they make at Okie Dog. All he needed was a cause that he could get behind. He was always down the squad cause he won every time. Ever since we was little, he could fight very well. Seen him whoop a grown man and we was only 12. Kept to himself unless they bothered him first. But like I was saying at the top of this verse, he busted up his hand on the head, all because he walked up to my homeboy and said,
where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
Okie Dog crib and y'all don't want none.
Yeah.
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from? Okie Dog crib and y'all don't want none. The hardest I know, he from Okie Dog crib. He pulled out a chopper, told me focusing on this. This can make a man brave, this can make a man a slave. And once you pull it out, ain't too many standing in your way. Trigger in your hand, you gotta understand. A lot of men use arms cause they ain't got hands. The shooter is respected much less than the gladiator. If you kill a n***a, then his homies gon' get at you later. You square up, win some, lose some. I'd even say the day like John Witherspoon's son. Homies almost out after 8 to 10 years, but I'ma say something that he might hate to hear. Look, now that I'm a grown man, 30-something years, and I'm out here trying to throw hands, it's green light for me to blast him up. So you better think twice before you ask a motherfucker.
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
Okie Dog crib and y'all don't want none.
Yeah.
Where you from, homie? Where you from?
What?
Well, that was Okie Dog from Merce's upcoming album, Have a Nice Life, excuse me. And you can pre-order that right now on iTunes. And if you want more information about Merce, you can go to strangemusicinc.com. Okie Dog interests me because it's lighthearted, especially if you watch the video, even a kind of humorous track, but it's also got a serious message about crafting one's own identity, not getting identity through association. And there's such a strong pressure to conform, especially when you're young. It takes real courage to stand in your own spirit. I'm just wondering what inspired you to write this track.
It's mostly a true story. And there was a gentleman I grew up with, and he was always one of my heroes. And I guess for me, now that I listen to it now with you, it feels like a tale of a gallant knight, like if I could describe it to anyone.
Mm.
And I think that most around the world, people tend to trivialize gang culture, especially in Los Angeles, and they don't understand it. But it's similar to any war that's been fought anywhere. And he was one of my heroes because he took a stand.
Mm.
And I was marginalized and kind of made to feel like an outsider growing up. And because I wasn't for gang culture and gang violence, I just didn't see the point in people killing one another, and especially in our community being such an oppressed people. Like us fighting each other wasn't the solution. And I had the benefit of moving out of my neighborhood for 3 or 4 years and going to living in the suburbs and getting some perspective.
Mm.
So I was a little unique in that stance, because everyone from my neighborhood was from the neighborhood gang for the most part.
Mm.
And if you weren't in a major gang, in the neighborhood gang, then you were picked on and bullied. And this individual took it upon himself to say, I'm going to just create my own gang. And he was very adept at fisticuffs. And so people would challenge him. And just like most black youth, we were all like very angry, aggressive people. Being oppressed and coming from, a background of slavery and being whipped and being brutalized by the police. Like, we're very confrontational, very aggressive people.
Mm.
But he focused that aggression in a unique way, and he was just looking for a fight all the time, but he wasn't trying to be a part of the group. He was just fighting everybody. So it could be Okie Dog Crip. If we were around a bunch of Bloods, it'd be Okie Dog Blood. If we were around a bunch of Crips, he just wanted to fight before they brought the fight to him.
Hmm.
And so the where you're from question, where I live, could mean life or death. And so many people I know have lost their lives over where you're from, and you say the wrong initials and there's a fight or, gun battle after. So instead of waiting for them to ask, he would just start the conflict immediately.
Hmm.
And he was a very intelligent, handsome guy. And he could have went a lot of different ways in life. And he chose the wrong path, but he chose it in his own way.
Mm.
And it's funny because doing that song, I had to call him in the penitentiary to get the okay.
Mm.
And I didn't, he called me and he said, I heard the song, I loved it. My cellmate's tired of hearing it. And I was like, you have a smartphone and the ability to download the music and you're playing it out loud on your tier, and it just amazed me. But he was, and also for him not to be forgotten and to know that I love him, and we still think about him. It's important for me to let my friends know they're incarcerated, and he's incarcerated for some nonsense.
Mm.
His neighbor didn't like him too much and made a call. He definitely was in possession of an illegal firearm, and he and his wife were having an argument, and he said it was domestic violence. And once that call comes in, the LAPD has to take you in, and then they searched the premises and they found his firearm, I think. And so he took a bad deal. He's doing 13 years, but the woman he's accused of abusing, I don't think there was no visible marks on her. She didn't want to press charges. And after 8 years, she's still driving 4 hours round trip 2 times a week to visit him with his daughter. And it's just, I know he's having a hard time. She's having a hard time. So the video, I wanted to be humorous because he wasn't an evil person. There's so many killers that are left on the streets of Los Angeles. And my friends, not one of them. And yeah. I thought he deserved an homage or a tribute.
Mm.
So he smiled. He loves. He's obviously he's watching the video. I was in Russia, and he texted me. He saw the video before I did. So I don't. Mm. It's not. I guess it's not too bad. It's not. It's bad. But at least he's able to participate in social media and various other activities.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, that's really moving. Yeah. I mean, there's so many people incarcerated for not very much, you know, and the whole three strikes thing. And I mean, it's very disappointing, I think, how we're dealing with those kind of issues in our society.
It's amazing. For me, like, you know, we're spending, I pay taxes, I pay a lot of taxes. And for me, I think about the people that, you know, we're paying child support, or helping take care of his daughter, which he was doing a very good job at as far as taking care of the bills and raising his daughter. Now she doesn't have a positive father figure in her household.
Mm.
And the family's receiving government assistance, which comes from my tax dollars. And I'm paying $60,000 a year to keep him incarcerated when he could be out earning a living as he was. Without being a burden on our economy, which is already suffering.
Yeah, 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 that's a whole other element. And also the cost of incarcerating people is so enormous. You know, one has to wonder if that money wasn't spent in prevention of crime, you know, what the results of that would be, or at least some of that money. It's just a way of forgetting about the problem, I think. You know, it's very expensive, but it's like, well, I don't have to think about it because, you know, those people are just out of my line of vision. And, it's very disappointing, I think, as a society. We really need to step up and change that somehow.
Yeah.
You mentioned him having social media and... you know, I was thinking about this message in the song about, you know, being who you are and not conforming, even, you know, putting your life at risk not to conform. And it seems to me that a lot with social media, a lot of people are performing now rather than living their lives. You know, they're kind of looking outwards to an audience to reflect back to them who they are. And I'm just wondering if you see this as creating even more pressure to belong and feel you have to live your life in a certain way.
Yeah, I can only imagine the pressure it is for a teen or a young person these days, because everything you do is, evaluated by how many likes it has. And that's so strange. And I think gives a false sense of reality to a lot of children.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the repercussions are going to be of this. It's going to be interesting. I hope it's only interesting and not tragic to watch. What we reap from what we're sowing right now with social media.
Yeah.
I think it should be, we should be monitoring it a little bit more carefully. And I think it's up to parents, but,
yeah,
you know, enforcing your child and instilling your child that, you know, you're loved regardless of how many likes you get. And I think that helped me a lot growing up, is that, you know, and to this day, I still know that no matter what I do, no matter how many records I sell, my mother loves me. And that's where I'm able to be self-deprecating in my songs.
Mm.
And give an honest point of view. And it's not about inflated egos or look at me, I have this car, look at me, I have this money, because I have someone looking at me and paying attention to me, and my mother is that person. And I think in America, especially in the Black community, a lot of mothers work and fathers aren't present, or if they are present, both parents are working to provide for their child and they don't get the chance to be at home and give them what they need more than any material thing is, which is love.
Yeah.
And so you get these rappers who want to wear these chains and gold in their teeth, and because they just want attention.
Yeah.
And they're killing each other because they're fighting for attention. They want to be noticed for and recognized, whether it's for a murder or for having the nicest car. Mm. But it all can boil back down to my mom and dad didn't pay enough attention to me.
Yeah.
And now you throw Instagram in that, like, I'm not getting enough likes. My mom's not paying attention to me.
Yeah.
I have to do something. I have to take off my clothes. I have to get a tattoo. I have to put a ring in my face. I have to do something to be noticed by someone.
Yeah.
I think we're not going to like what's coming up.
No. There's a psychologist I really like called Alice Miller, and she studied artists a lot, and she made a comment that she said that all anybody needed in their life, you know, the base level was an enlightened witness, I think she called it. It's like somebody in your life as you're growing up who sees you as you really are. And so, you know, even if you don't have a perfect home situation or whatever, if there's somebody who can really see you and value you for who you are, then that's much less damaging. And I think what you're saying is, you know, a lot of these people, they don't have that enlightened witness. They don't have anybody who's really reflecting back to them that they're okay, you know, that you are lovable, you have things to offer to the world. And like you say, then you're looking out to try and get that confirmation in inappropriate ways, perhaps, on the outside.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And it's my wife and I, you know, adhere to that philosophy, and we, you know, my attempt to make a difference. I grew up, you know, infatuated with the Black Panthers and the Black Power movement of the 70s and 60s. And, you know, a lot of people, their answer, most people who are infatuated with it tend to replicate or, you know, reproduce some of those groups. And I didn't think that was the way. I think the revolution can't look like it did in the 60s or 70s, because then it's not a revolution. It's nothing new.
Right.
So my idea with her was we can start adopting children.
Mm.
We adopted two children, two Black children, and one was a 15-year-old and one was a baby.
Mm.
And the 15-year-old, I tried to be that enlightened witness for him, and it's just too late. You know, and he's been in and out of foster care since he's been with us, and, you know, right now he's in a facility, and it's, you know, no matter how much money or time or opportunities we presented him with, he was more concerned with posting weed on Instagram and having new shoes. And, you know, it's just, you know, you have to reach these children at the right age, because at a certain point, if they do not have that enlightened witness, they're, I think, may be forever on a path.
Yeah.
That is, you know, unchangeable. I definitely dealt with the side effects of social media.
Yeah.
Because no matter what I did, he wanted to get 300 likes. It didn't matter how much I told him I loved him, or I liked his outfit, or I was proud of his artwork. He was still searching for the outside validation.
Yeah. I think that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, the years up to about 7 or 8, once you're over 7 or 8, it does become much more difficult to make inroads. And then it becomes about later down the line, where that person has to try and reach a point of crisis for themselves and go inside. I mean, I don't think it's pointless loving someone, you know, but as you're saying, to make a direct effect when somebody's already developed all these protective mechanisms to feel safe in the world, it's hard for them to let go of those, because it's when you're young, it's almost feels life-threatening to be exposed to no love. And so when you've developed all those protections, it's very hard to feel you can let them go.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wish the best for him. I hope he can turn around and feel your love for him, because that's a great thing that you're giving him.
Yeah, you know, we're hoping for the same. You know, I told him, you know, no matter what, I will pray for you, and when you hit rock bottom, give me a call and we'll fix it, you know?
Yeah.
But he's going to have, like you said, that crisis that he's going to have to unfortunately experience that, and hopefully rebound in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. The next track I'd like to play from the album is No More Control. And again, this has got a great video that listeners can check out on YouTube. It's a very moving story. So I'm going to play that now. This is No More Control from the upcoming Merce album, Have a Nice Life.
Jogging through the junkyard, kicking the can. Never would I think I had the world in my hand. 17 times circumnavigate the globe. A traveler's tradition, my religion is the road. Broke the mold, explored all the options. The quickest way to curate the cash, so I clocked in. Own a job, no training wheels. Told my mama I'ma make it cause I say I will. Say I will. Till the wheels fall off. Yes, yes, y'all, to the beat it don't stop. Between a rock and a hard place, came up out the ghetto with my boys, no scar face. But is my mind playing tricks? If the world is really mine, how I ain't got. Still they stop and they frisk, but it's never gonna change till we stop and resist. Drug dealers, comic books, white girls and real skateboards, bandanas and malt liquor, Japanese cartoons and straight killers. They tell us get out the ghetto and get rich, but when you really a rebel, you don't fit. We all trying to find our niche, gotta grab it by the throat and make the world joke. It's the American way, plug into the drive and let the narrative play. We obsessed with nothing but the best. You would on your own or be a drone with the death wish. Defy definition, repress repetition. Get money, get sex, the addiction. The depression, the stress, the affliction. Get ready, get set, go, we on a mission. For police brutality up at the park, but when we killing ourselves, don't nobody want to march. We got to start to take a look in the mirror. If we don't respect ourselves, then they always gonna fear us. If black lives matter, then black lives matter, and the color of the killer shouldn't even be a factor. Most of these rappers ain't equipped to lead, cause most of these rappers illiterate, can't read. This is educated street music for the educated street movement. It's messed up what the police is doing, but take a look at what we doing.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest from the arts, Merce. We're going to go to a commercial break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Nevada's wild horses are disappearing from our rangelands at an alarming rate. Every day, horses are rounded up, captured, sold, and sent off to be cruelly slaughtered for food overseas. The horses you see out your window today could end up on someone's dinner plate tomorrow. We simply must do something to save them. This great country was built on the backs of the horses. They helped us plow our fields, pull our wagons, and they deserve all the dignity and respect afforded other American icons. The horse helped us craft this nation we know and revere today. This is country music star Lacey J. Dalton. I have dedicated my life to save Nevada's wild horses, but I cannot save them without your help. Your generous donations are the only chance some of these horses have. Visit letemrun.com for more information. Join me. Nevada's wild horses are disappearing from our rangelands at an alarming rate. Visit letemrun.com.
This portion of the show is sponsored by Dina Scopatoni, who is an award-winning fashion model, academic teaching modern art history at Cabrillo College, and Vogue fashion photographer. An ocular centrist, Dina's photographs range from fashion editorials to soul-catching portraits to evocative documentary images. The vibrant nature of her work evokes the glamour of Mario Testino, Annie Leibovitz and Helmut Newton, while expressing an understanding of composition and contrast which is all her own. Trained as an art historian at the University of London's esteemed Courtauld Institute, Dina Scopatoni looks for the intellectual and visual contrasts in each of her photographs. If you're interested in viewing her wonderful work, you can go to dinascopatoni.com. That's dinascopetoni.com. Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, Merce. And before the break, we were listening to No More Control, which is one of the singles that's currently available from the upcoming Merce album, Have a Nice Life, which comes out on the 18th of May. You can pre-order it on iTunes, and I suggest that you do that. The main thrust of this song, Merce, is Black Lives Matter, but it also seems to speak to the general cultural violence in America and the way we jump so quickly to solve conflict with violence. I'm wondering what made you want to write this song in particular.
The overall song was made before as the third verse was done. And the overall concept of no more control was just getting rid of the things that control us, as we were talking about before, whether it's your religion or your personal ideology that's controlling you. Like, I feel like, if you're a Christian, you're supposed to do this, and you're not supposed to associate with these people. Like, there's so many forces that are shaping you to conform to some, to fit into a box.
Mm.
And I never did. And I think that, some of the most brilliant people and the people who contribute the most to society are those who step outside of those boxes or blur the lines between those boxes.
Yeah.
We're often told, where I come from, is if you get out and you do make it, then it's your job to, purchase things and flaunt your success.
Yeah.
And supposedly that sends back a message of positivity to the community. But what it really does is create a deeper divide and create resentment between you and your community.
Mm.
And it's not unfortunately, as a Black American, you can't do what white Americans do. And that's what white Americans do when they get into, come into money or find some type of financial success. They buy expensive things, and their people are happy for them because a lot of their family and friends are able to attain the success and see it as possible or have already attained the same success, and you're joining them, so it's a celebration. But for us, so many of us are still disenfranchised and oppressed that when we do the same things, it creates this resentment, and it makes people feel worse about the situation and makes them feel worse about your success.
Yeah.
And to this point, the police brutality issue, it's we can't handle it the way we're handling it. I won't say it's our fault, but we're contributing to the problem by making this violent music. And every time a white person that doesn't live in our community, we have to understand that there's a lot of people that don't have contact with us. So when they see us on television, all they see is us with our shirts off and a bunch of tattoos and gold and guns.
Mm.
And when they come into the community and do their job of policing us, they're fearful of us. They don't understand us. And they're scared.
Yeah.
So they're going to react this way. Or they are people from our community, as some of the officers in this recent Baltimore tragedy are African-American. And maybe they didn't grow up in the neighborhood, or maybe they got out of the neighborhood and they're scared because they feel like these people are hungry and desperate, and I have something that they want. Either way, but yeah, overall, it's a symptom of the culture of violence, and America meets any conflict with violence. but we were a nation that was founded on violence. You know, we left Britain, and I say we because I'm really sick of not being American. I know I wasn't. It wasn't we that left England, but I'm an American. You know, we left England, and then told you know the Queen to go screw herself, and we're not paying these taxes. And then we got here, and the settlers said, "Oh, it's warm here. It's nicer than England. If we move west, so let's kill all these natives." You know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if a lot of the pilgrims were direct descendants of the Vikings, but I watched that on the History Channel. I can see where this cultural violence comes from. And if you come from the European continent, the earth is very unforgiving. It's very cold. It's very, so, you know, the Vikings are killing each other for land and food because the earth is so, you know, Mother Nature is so cold to the European. Mm. And so it gets to this warm place where people are walking around half nude and growing corn and they have irrigation and all these things, and we'll just take it. And I think a lot of people, especially black people of color, make it about race, and it wasn't about these people are brown, we're going to kill them. It was these people have something that we need to live, and we're going to take all of it. And we did that, you know, Europeans were doing that to each other. The Vikings were attacking other Europeans of the same skin color. Pilgrims didn't come here and attack natives because they were black. They attacked them because they wanted their land.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
You know, they made slaves of black people because that's what needed to be done in order for them to be successful.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after that, we fought each other in the Civil War. After we killed all the natives, and we fought each other in the Civil War. Then once our country was established, it's who else can we fight around the world?
Yep.
We're just a violent people. And until we as Americans say, what's wrong with us? It's not just the police. The police are just a symptom of a culture of violence that has been growing for hundreds of years here.
Yeah.
And we're always looking for a fight. And you're right. Anytime there's a conflict or a debate or a difference in opinion, we're going to nuke you. We're going to impose sanctions. You know, we're stronger. We're richer. We're smarter. We're right. We're going to kill you.
Yeah.
And that has to stop at some point. But it's not the police's problem, and it's not the black community's problem. But instead of protesting against the police, we're killing more of each other every year. You know, there's 500 police-related deaths across the nation. There's 1,500. Black-on-black homicides in most major cities in America. You multiply that times 100, you have 150,000 black-on-black homicides compared to 500 police-on-black male homicides.
Right. Yeah.
And we're mad at the police. We're just being hypocrites. And to me, we look like idiots. But if a white person says that, they're racist. And if I say it, I'm a sellout. But yeah. I think the real problem is, you know, the culture of violence in America, and I'm not in a position, as a black male, I'm not in a position to change all of America, but I can start in my community. And, you know, instead of us getting together in the streets, we should get together in the streets and put our children in school every day. And, you know, if that many people are going to get together, there's better things to do. And if you have a white person standing next to you holding the sign that says Black Lives Matter, and they're empathizing with your struggle, the best thing for you to do is to tell that person all lives matter. It's
yes.
not just black lives.
Yeah.
And that's going to create more love and unity instead of you're making yourself a victim by asking this white person to support your cause in the name of black lives. Like,
yeah.
they're taking pity on you, and it shouldn't be that way. We should come together as just, you know, as Americans, and then hopefully we can work on the human race.
Yeah.
But we can compartmentalize it for now. And I think if Americans were less violent, it'd be better for the world in general.
Yeah, yeah. There's a really interesting book called The Chalice and the Blade by Rianne Eisler, and it's kind of a reevaluation of a lot of archaeological digs. And basically what they found from that is that sort of 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, there were a lot of communities in Europe that were what she calls partnership communities. They didn't have weapons, they didn't have fortifications. Men and women seemed to have, you know, be very equal, and you know, it seemed to work. And then unfortunately at a certain point you got the kind of tribes coming in. I don't know from exactly where the steppes, I think at Russia, you know. And then from then on we've had this kind of what she calls a dominator society, where, you know, people are wanting to impose rather than work with other people and respect them. It's all about domination. And I think, you know, I'm an American citizen as well as a British citizen. And, you know, that's something I think we really do have to work on in America, is that this idea of just dominating and might being right is getting us really nowhere very quickly.
You're personally single-handedly trying to make me cancel my Netflix subscription. I have to read this book now. And after looking at Alice Miller, and there's so many jewels you're giving me, and you're going to ruin my whole TV schedule.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's very un-American of you.
Yeah, I don't watch a lot of TV. Maybe you can tell. You also say in No More Control, you know, part of the message is if you're really a rebel, that you don't fit. And in the video, the central character, the rebel, is this quiet young man trying to make a difference. And you say the song is educated street music for the educated street movement. And the idea that dumb is cool is so pervasive in our society, you know, that somehow if you use your intelligence, you're elitist. Is this something you were also trying to say in this song?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like, you know, we have to, everything has to become compartmentalized. If you're tough, you can't be smart. If you're, you know, like, there's just, your ignorance is a badge of honor in this country, and it's saddening. But yeah, definitely, that was a message I was trying to get across. We have to stop, you know, watching so much television and reading more. And it's amazing to me how many people ask me, well, what's the secret to rapping? And I always tell every kid I meet when I speak at high schools, and people ask me, it's true. I was like, you have to read in order to write. It's amazing to me how many people become rappers or artists and don't read or don't have an appreciation for any art.
Right.
You know, cinema, visual art, it, sculpture, like, you know, I don't feel like, you know, and I honestly, and I can say this, I don't feel like rappers and a lot of black people from the 80s till now have made art. I don't consider it art. Like, we're the first people in the history of music to celebrate demeaning women and killing ourselves. Like, there's been no music like this before us. There's no art like this before us.
No.
We're abusing art, and I don't think we're being made aware of what art is. And I was fortunate enough to be bussed into a school where I had an art history teacher.
Mm.
And she, you know, her name is Linda Shoemate, and I'll never forget, she changed my life. Hmm. Because I learned to watch film as art instead of just junk food. And, you know, we read Heart of Darkness and watched Apocalypse Now, and, you know, she broke down The Godfather in ways that I could understand, and she compared, you know, George Lucas, it showed the influence of Joseph Campbell on George Lucas and all these things, and that changed my life. And so when I create music, I feel like it's a privilege to be part of this legacy, this, you know, as humans, this is what we'll be remembered by years from now. And it's important that we make it mean something, that there's some depth to it, that there's something being expressed that means something.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of hip hop does that, but it's because we're not educated, and it's not all our fault we're not educated.
No.
But I was still able, after that, after having a teacher like that, after 10th grade, I really wasn't concerned with grades. I was just concerned with getting the syllabus and reading what I wanted to read. And I don't believe that I have to turn in a paper to you and you grade my interpretation of someone else's art. You don't know what Thomas Pynchon was talking about in Gravity's Rainbow.
Mm.
But as long as I read it and I have my own interpretation of it, that's fine.
Yeah.
And so I got a lot of F's and D's, but I took it upon myself to continue my education. And I think it's important, especially black youth, understand that you can continue your education, because there's something in me that wanted to rebel. I didn't want, most of my teachers were white, and I didn't want their approval. I can enjoy European art, but I don't have to turn in my interpretation of it to you to get an A or a B. I just have to understand it and appreciate it and respect it, or not. I don't like Monet, and that's okay, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I know who he is, and, you know, and I think that that's in. And when I went to Paris, it's important for me to go to the Louvre. And, you know, I think that's what needs to be taught to black youth, the educated street movement. Like, you can still have this rebellious, because, like, when you're really a rebel, you don't fit. And that means nobody is all anything. Like, when you're truly living your life, you're not going to be able to be compartmentalized. And then capitalism, you want your ketchup to be made by Heinz, you want it in a red bottle, and this is this. But that's not the same with people. We're not products. And I think living in a capitalistic society, we all become products. I'm a redneck. I only do this. Mm. But, you know, I'm a kid from the ghetto, and I love NASCAR. I'm somewhat of a hipster, but I hate craft beer. And, like, these things are okay.
Yeah.
We can't all, there's no, if you're, you know, and when I say, I think we're all rebels and we're all unique, and we have to, you know, encounter each individual as an individual instead of quickly putting them into a box, because that's what's best for consumers. It's most efficient when you're at the grocery store, but that's not a way to live your life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, part of the problem of all of this is how we define success. And in America, success is predominantly defined financially, you know, how much you make. It's like the most capitalistic country in the world. And I think that's soul destroying for a lot of people, because there's a lot of people who money isn't the most important thing, you know, and to be valued only in that way. I mean, there's so many jobs that are vocational and creative, and those jobs don't pay that well. But does that mean you're not a success?
Yeah, and then I think it messes up even, you know, as far as our, you know, our healthcare. Like, there's doctors who don't want to be doctors. They don't care about the well-being of people. Yeah. They became doctors because it made the most money. They become lawyers because it makes the most money, instead of doing what you feel like you're called to do or you're meant to do.
Yeah.
And money is success. And where I come from, it's money and survival. Your success, a lot of my friends don't do anything with their life because, well, I didn't end up in jail, I don't have any illegitimate children, and I'm not dead, I won.
Mm, yeah.
Because so many of our contemporaries, our peers are dead or in jail or have 8 children by 8 different women. So you miss those 3 bullets and you think you're a success and you're not motivated to do anything else.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, whether, you know, but yeah, financial success is seen as the overall success. That's what success looks like, money.
Yeah.
And for us, it either looks like money or survival.
Yeah.
But there's more to it. And I think real success is just, I feel, for me, it's being happy and being able to help other people. And it took me a long time, not a long time, it took me some time to adjust to that. Once I had money, I wasn't happy.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to those people, if you familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I mean, if your basic needs are not met, you know, such as feeling safe in the world and having enough money to live, it's very hard to show higher needs, you know, interest in emotion and love and spirituality when you don't have those lower needs met. And so, you know, that's a vital area that I think needs to be addressed. Because like you say, if you're worried about whether you're going to survive till the next day, it's hard to think about a lot more than that.
Yeah. And I think that, and that's with hip hop culture, that you have a bunch of people who didn't, you know, it's just you're just surviving because you didn't have the opportunity to think of anything else.
Yeah.
And I remember having a conversation with my mother because I told her, and she maybe thought, but I know I knew I was going to be dead by the time I was 18, just the path I was on and the way I was living. And when I got to 28 and I was still alive, I realized that I didn't have a life plan. I was just going and going and going. And when I adopted my child, a friend of mine made me, it's the pyramid you're talking about, the hierarchy of needs.
Hierarchy of needs, it's Abraham Maslow. You should check him out too. It's amazing. I love his work. He's all about self-actualization. He was the first psychologist to study healthy people. Up until then, everyone was just studying dysfunction, you know, why people had mental problems. And he looked at people who are what he calls self-actualized, who are being all that they can be. And that's what he wrote about. It's really interesting.
When I, you know, when I adopted my teenager, my friend made sure I familiarized myself with that pyramid. And to know what I was dealing with this kid who did not have his needs met at all, any of his needs met from an early age. It didn't help me per se with him, but it definitely opened my eyes to a lot. I was like, wow, this explains so much.
Yeah. On a kind of lighter note, I was going to say, you've got some real love songs in your repertoire, both on solo albums and collaborations, and songs where you express what you feel about sex and what motivates you. And, you know, as a woman, that's interesting to me, rather than just being told that you're really good in bed, which is what a lot of hip hop songs spend their time doing, you know, which is, I suppose, got a place, but it's very one dimensional. I was wondering whether I can look forward to some more nuanced songs about love and sex on your new album, or are you covering other topics?
No, definitely. Being married and not having sex with any other woman for 5 years has been a real interesting experience and journey for me. So I definitely have a song dealing with that called The Worst on the album about temptation and, trying to stay faithful in the world of being a performer. And then I have a song called Mi Corazón, which is, I'm really proud of myself because it's a English-Spanish song, which I wrote all the Spanish and English lyrics to.
Oh, wow.
But it's, about me growing up. I was definitely infatuated with Mexican girls. And El Salvadorian girls, because most of the girls in L.A.
Right.
But at that time, we weren't allowed to date because there's, you know, cultural politics and gang politics between black and Latino people.
Right.
So I did a song about that, and I did a song called Black Girls Be Like, which is kind of my version of Keep Your Head Up by Tupac.
Right.
But celebrating black women for things other than their physical attributes.
Right, yeah.
So definitely, I never stop talking about love because, as we stated before, I feel if you look at rap and you take the 100 best songs, they're going to be about violence. And you take the 100 greatest songs of all time, and without Inner Sandman by Metallica and the occasional rap song by Public Enemy, most of them are going to be the top 100 songs. If Rolling Stone puts them all in a magazine, are going to be mostly about a woman or love. And I think hip-hop misses out on that. And I love it because I have no competition when it gets to that realm.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
But I wish more of my friends and colleagues would address love. But it's a weird thing for me to encounter because I'm with a woman who didn't grow up with a father in her household or a functional marriage, and I didn't really grow up in a household with a father or a functional marriage, and now we're trying to create that for my son, and we have no idea what that looks like.
Mm.
And then you compound that with we both grew up in a culture and listen to music where women are demeaned and not appreciated, and men who treat women with respect are demeaned and not appreciated.
Yeah.
So subconsciously, we both feel like we're sellouts. You know, she feels like I'm such and such a loser because I'm treating her correctly, and she feels like she doesn't deserve to be treated correctly, subconsciously on some level.
Mm.
And we're trying to create something that neither of us have ever seen, which is a functional marriage.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. So a lot of that, I think, sentiment is expressed in those songs as well.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's all of us are going through these kind of issues. And so it's so relevant. It's so mainstream. And yet, it just like you say, nobody's really talking about it. I mean, everybody does want love. You can talk about sleeping with 100 different women, but at, you know, the core, everybody wants to feel love and to give love. I think, you know, it's just such a human condition. So I'm really glad that you do that in your work, and you do it in such a thoughtful way and an honest way. It seems really authentic. I mean, not everything you're saying about yourself is good, you know, but it's authentic, you know. It's really takes you inside the way a man can think as well, you know, if you're a woman listening. It's very interesting.
I hope women understand men. And I watch Sex in the City to try to understand women.
Oh, God. It doesn't help much.
I'm
not sure that's very representative of women, really.
Not at all.
At least I hope it isn't. Some women. you've said that Travis O'Gwynn, co-founder of Strange Music, says, "Do you, and we're going to push it." That seems like a dream for someone who's in it for the art rather than fame as a primary motivator. Do you feel you have done you on the upcoming album?
More so than ever. I feel like I've been doing me my whole career, but I haven't known who I am. And my wife and I went to marriage counseling, and our doctor was a guy from Coney Island. He was like, "Oh, you do rap? Well, I grew up on rap, like at my prom with Sugar Hill Gang." And he told me, you know, I used to soak my shoelaces in water overnight and then stretch them out and iron them and make fat laces. And like, I was like, wow, like I didn't even know. I thought you just bought them at the store. Like, he's like, "I'm a real B-boy." He's like, "But I don't resent younger rappers like yourself or the young kids, because Melly Mel was 27 when he made The Message. Chuck D had graduated college when he started Public Enemy. And rap is the only, and rap and punk are the only forms of music where young people write and record their own music. Most pop music and R&B was written, you know, Jackson 5 was written by Smokey Robinson, who had been through something and journeyed through life and had learned some things and had a place to speak from. So he was making quality music, and Michael Jackson was singing quality lyrics.
Yeah.
But so I feel like this album, I was able to do me for the first time, because I'm at a point, I'm 37 now, I've traveled the world, I've read a little bit, I've loved, I've lived, I've lost. I feel like I have something to say now, instead of just being angry or passionate or wanting that enlightened witness, as you put it. I have something to say, and I feel like I have a leg up on a lot of young rappers, and I feel like now I can make a contribution. So this is my first album of having something to say, you know, being married for 5 years, adopting two kids, burying, you know, both of my stepfather and my father, you know, losing a couple friends, you know, going in debt to the IRS. Like, I've experienced a lot of ups and downs, and I have some wisdom to impart, and I definitely have something to say now. And I thought I had something to say when I was younger, but I realized I wasn't saying much.
Well, you're probably saying something different, because, you know, you're continually growing, and your perspective's different now, isn't it, with all those experiences that you've had. And yeah. I wanted to ask you, in your song "Road Is My Religion," you say you will keep campaigning till I reach my goal. It's obvious you're into continuous learning and personal growth. So I'm wondering what your goal is now.
Wow. My goal, musically, I would love to, you know, win a Grammy and sell a million records. My goal as a human is to meet and to spread as much love as possible. You know, every night when I get on stage, I make sure I tell everyone I love them and mean it, and try to shake as many hands as I can and meet as many people and listen to them and learn what I can from them. I think ultimately my goal is to share as much as love with people as possible. And that's kind of where the title of the album, "Have a Nice Life," came from, because I still get frustrated and want to tell people to, you know, go screw themselves and get out of my face, and I get angry. But I found that just telling everyone to have a nice life is the best way to say something positive without, making, like, this moment in my life is temporary. I'm at the grocery store, and you're very rude to me, but you're not upset with me.
Yeah.
There's something going on with you. So the best thing I can say to you is have a nice life. Instead of transferring more negative energy to you, I just want, you know, be well and hope you work it out, whatever you're going through. I'm not going to internalize this energy. I'm just going to leave it here for you and, work it out.
Yeah.
So I think that's my goal, you know, spread as much love as possible. And now to raise my son and make sure I'm the best husband and father I could be.
Yeah. That's great. That's a big goal that I'm sure you will attain it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Very thoughtful, dedicated person. So thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your thoughts. And it's been great having you.
Yes.
And I want to just remind people again that the album Have a Nice Life comes out on the 18th of May. You can pre-order it now on iTunes. And you can also go to strangemusicinc.com to find out more information about Merce.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. It was a great interview. I Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, you're totally welcome, and good luck with the tour. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. I look forward to seeing you next week.